The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, good morning. Golly, lots
yes,
to talk about.
How amazing one day can be in the life of a country and in politics. But even before we get on to talking about politics, I just wanted to address this issue of the Shireen Abu Akleh bullet that apparently has now fallen into the hands, or at least a picture of it fall into the hands of Al Jazeera. They claim that this is the bullet that killed Shireen Abu Akleh, the journalist who was killed in recent crossfire between Israeli and renegade groups within the area of Judea and Samaria. And they claim that they have the bullet. And of course, the picture of the bullet shows relatively clearly that it's an IDF issue bullet. And therefore, that must be the end of the story. So I just want to say to people who are following the story that, of course, it's quite easy to get hold of a bullet and just take a picture of it and say, that's the bullet that killed her, right? That's not the difficult bit. Obviously, one has to do the forensics in order to make sure that that's actually the bullet that was drawn from her body, the one that actually killed her, A. And B, we've already acknowledged that there is a distinct possibility that an IDF bullet may well have killed her. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it killed her on purpose, and it doesn't necessarily pander to the rhetoric, to the story, to the storyline that people are trying to promote, which says, oh, you know, the IDF go after journalists and the IDF go after innocent individuals who happen just to be in the middle of a crossfire incident involving
clearly armed. Why would they? I mean, what would the point be? You know, that's what I keep asking, is what's to be gained? Does Israel have anything to be gained by this? Certainly not.
There's nothing to be gained or lost. I mean, whether the bullet was an IDF bullet or whether it wasn't an IDF bullet, I don't think is going to change anything. You know, journalists who go into the line of fire endanger themselves, and that doesn't necessarily mean that whoever happens to have pulled the trigger that shot the bullet did so on purpose or even saw that there was a journalist amongst those people. It doesn't really lend itself to any of that story. So just to put everything into context, I'm certainly not denying that that is the bullet, but we certainly don't have proof that it was a bullet. And even if it was, so where does that take us next? It was a great tragedy. Nobody wanted to see a journalist innocently killed in the line of fire. But unfortunately, that's just what happened. And unfortunately, what's happened, we just have to take the context of what's going on, you know, even when they're publishing bullets like that.
Okay, let's talk about the big news. Not that that isn't, but it was announced yesterday that the ruling coalition plans to dissolve Knesset and take the country back to elections. Why did they take this step?
Well, it was a somewhat unexpected step by the coalition yesterday, even though, as you heard from our conversation yesterday morning, the direction that this is taking us was somewhat inevitable. But it was interesting that Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett decided to hold a joint news conference, which I think was something of strength. I think it was a show of strength from the two of them, because over the last week or two, I think they've sort of been a little bit out of control of this political bus that's been rolling down the hill and heading to taking Israel towards an election. And I think that the opposition had managed to somehow gain a little control of this political vehicle that's traveling along here, deciding when they wish to bring a vote of no confidence to the Knesset. They were really driving the vehicle. And yesterday, I think that Naftali Bennett and that Yair Lapid took control back for a moment. Not that it necessarily helps their coalition government, but it just kind of allowed them to take control of this vehicle. And the first thing that they said was that they have decided that because it is not possible to extend the law that will allow Israeli law to govern in Judea and Samaria, and they can see that that bill will not pass through the Knesset, the only way to extend Israeli law over Judea and Samaria beyond the 30th of June date is to take Israel to elections. Once we go to elections, then that law automatically extends until a new government is elected and a new Knesset is elected and a new government appointed. So that was the first point that they made. The second point that they made was that there will be a smooth transition of power the moment the Knesset is dissolved from current Prime Minister Naftali Bennett to Yair Lapid, as agreed in the coalition agreement. So that was the second point, which I think was really important to make in order to just give the public at large the understanding of what will be happening next. And I think that they really did grab control back, and I was quite impressed with the cooperation between the two of them, even though one was clearly giving up his position as prime minister and the other one was just about to assume it. I think it was a real show of strength. And as of yesterday, we understood that the likelihood of a bill being brought to the Knesset to dissolve it by the governing coalition would probably be done next week. That was the way that things were presented. By the time we woke up this morning, that had all changed, because there did leave a little possible doubt about whether former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu might nevertheless be able to form a majority, get a majority of the Knesset together and form an alternative right-wing government even before the Knesset is dissolved. Wow, that possibility does exist, even though it seems to be a relatively small possibility, but it does exist. And so as of this morning, it seems more likely that the governing coalition will bring the bill to dissolve the Knesset already tomorrow. And once that is done, it effectively prevents the likelihood of Netanyahu forming an alternative government within this Knesset. So that seems to me to be the most likely situation over the course of the next day or two. I'm expecting now that the bill to dissolve the Knesset will be brought probably tomorrow, and that we will dissolve the Knesset and go directly into an election process. The election likely to take place on either the 25th of October or the 1st of November, one of those 2 days, always on a Tuesday, and of course allowing a minimum of 4 months in order to get the election period rolling. That seems to be the most likely situation now. And of course, the moment the Knesset is dissolved, Yair Lapid will immediately assume position as prime minister. We understand that Naftali Bennett will remain in the government and he will be the alternate prime minister and will also be responsible for Iran affairs. That will be a particular portfolio that he will that will be created and that he will carry forward. Obviously, the situation with Iran, quite concerning. We've discussed that at length over the past few days and weeks. And of course, the prospect of an election would be joy and music to the Iranian ears, because then potentially a little bit of attention may be diverted away from Iran and onto internal political issues that the Israelis will need to deal with. So the Iranians are thinking that this is going to be really good news for them and for their attempts to increase their uranium enrichment. Another announcement today by the International Atomic Energy Agency that Iran intends to increase its uranium enrichment at the Fordow nuclear site underground. And so they think that they might be able to get away with that. But Naftali Bennett will be there with the portfolio to keep a very, very careful watch on things that are going on in Iran. So that is the latest political situation in Israel as it stands today. I expect that by the time we end this week, we will already have dissolved the Knesset and we will be heading to elections.
Absolutely incredible. Looking back, how will this his period as prime minister be seen, do you think?
Well, I think that Naftali Bennett, and obviously, you know, time will help us to look at things somewhat in retrospect. But I think that Naftali Bennett has been an interesting combination of both a great success and also something of a failure. And the reason that I say that is because I think his success comes from the fact that he's really put the country first in almost every respect. And that was one of the things that was reiterated and confirmed by Yair Lapid yesterday at the joint announcement, when he said that this is an example of the prime minister putting the country first and putting himself behind that need. So he's effectively giving up his seat as prime minister because he understands that if we don't dissolve the Knesset, there could potentially be chaos in Judea and Samaria where law won't properly rule. And that for him was a non-starter. So he is willing to give up his seat as prime minister, give up his government in favor of bringing more stability to the state of Israel and to the people who live in that area. And I think that that is really what summarizes Naftali Bennett's period as prime minister. I think he's really put the country first. I think he's done whatever he can in order to get the wheels of government back in motion after an extended period of time when we went through all of these elections and the wheels of government were effectively slowed down, even brakes put on in many respects, and he managed to re-oil that and to get all of that moving again, making various appointments, political appointments that needed to be made that had been stalled to get a budget passed. He managed to do all of that, and of course to get the IDF ready for whatever is coming next. We're in the process of appointing a new chief of general staff in the IDF. That decision-making process is currently underway, and Defense Minister Benny Gantz has promised that no change in government will derail that process or will effectively change his determination to appoint the right person to the right job, particularly when it comes to the IDF chief of general staff. So I think that Naftali Bennett has really put his heart and soul into bringing back this idea that the country comes before the individuals, comes before the political parties, comes before even some of his own long-felt policies and his political view on the world, because of course he's had to compromise in terms of leading a coalition government that looked from the start like it could never work, and yet it did work for a while, but now of course we've seen the fact that it ultimately hasn't worked for him. Mm. And so he's really changed the nature of politics, because his predecessor, former Prime Minister Netanyahu, was exactly the opposite. People felt that he was doing everything in order to promote himself and in order to protect his own seat and in order to protect his own family and the close people around him. And people felt that this was coming at the expense of the public office that he was holding. And I think that Naftali Bennett has changed that. The problem, of course, the failure is that it has cost him his job, it has cost him his party, it has cost him his coalition, because he's been unable to keep people with him, to bring the coalition with him and to bring the electorate with him in terms of taking this route. And I think it's very, very sad indeed. It's a sad statement of our political world where people who put the country first don't succeed.
It is terrible if one thinks about it, because then you have to be more cunning and more political and less transparent. Not easy at all. But there's no doubt by tomorrow there'll be more news about this, and we'll continue that with that conversation. Jerusalem and Tel Aviv both rose in the rankings of the world's most expensive cities. What's the main driver of this increase?
Just when you thought it couldn't get worse, yeah, it has got worse. Absolutely. So this is a cost of living ranking that's put together by a global consultancy firm called ECA International. They do this every year. They rank 207 cities according to measures including price rises and rents and gasoline and food and drink and business services and things like that. And Tel Aviv this year has risen to sixth place on the list of the world's most expensive cities. In front of Tel Aviv are only Hong Kong, which is apparently the world's most expensive city, followed by New York, Geneva, London, and Tokyo. Those are the five cities that are ahead of Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is number six. And I think some of the things that have really driven the increase, the escalation or the promotion of Tel Aviv up the list. I don't know if it's really a promotion. I think it's one of those things that you don't want to go up the list. But I think that fuel is one of the things that really stands out. I think Israel has the second highest fuel price in the world after Hong Kong, according to this particular survey. And the other thing which interestingly stood out was the strength of the Israeli shekel, during this period of time, which apparently also has an influence over things. Now, of course, the strength of the shekel really affects people who come from abroad to visit Israel and will find the currency very, very strong, and therefore things very expensive indeed. But let's not kid ourselves that even for people living here who don't have to suffer the exchange rate issue, things are enormously, enormously expensive. The cost of living is just amazing. And just by the way, Jerusalem, not quite sixth on the list, but 15th on the list, preceded only by Zurich, Shanghai, Guangzhou, Seoul, San Francisco, Shenzhen, Singapore, and Beijing. Those are the only cities in the world that are more expensive than Jerusalem. Interestingly, the cheapest city on the list of 207, Istanbul. We've spoken a lot about Istanbul in recent weeks, and that may be one of the reasons why Israelis are so eager to go and visit there in spite of the security threats. But just talking about the cost of living and issues, I mean, the price rises that Israel has seen with the fuel rises and with the supply chain issues has been substantial. And we're now seeing again springing up around Jerusalem and Tel Aviv people protesting in their tents, setting up tents around the city to protest against the cost of living. People can't afford to pay their rents. People are just struggling in general. The cost of rental has gone up dramatically over the last little while, and people are really, really struggling. And so we're seeing again these protests being set up all over the place to protest against what is really a prohibitive cost of living, not only for people coming from abroad, but even indeed for people living in Israel.
Absolutely frightening. It is 8 o'clock. Anthony Reich, thank you. As always, we'll catch you tomorrow morning at 7:45.